This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
What we have seen is that it spreads much faster. It's left to be seen whether it will end faster.
That was Professor Abdul Karim, co-chair of the South Africa's COVID-19 Advisory Committee on the coronavirus mutation that is affecting the country. Details coming up. Also, Ugandan opposition leader Robert Chagulani has been confined to his home since last week's presidential election. And protests in Tunisia continue for the fourth day. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Yesterday, the Ugandan government blocked the United States ambassador from visiting opposition leader Robert Chagulani, known as Bobi Wine. He has been confined to his home since last week's presidential election. Later, Reuters News reported that the government is accusing the ambassador, Natalie Brown, of trying to subvert the election. For the latest on what's happening in Kampala, VOA's Kate Pondawson spoke with reporter Catherine Nambi.
The situation in Kampala is calm. People have returned. Most of the people have returned to their workplaces. Others are already in their shops, have opened their businesses. Although security still remains tight because we are still having another round of elections. We are having for the district chair persons and then the mayors, the city mayors. So security is still on the road. People are busy. Well, there will be another election. The only place that is known to be busy right now is Kamoja. It is the Kampala suburb where the National Unity Platform, NUP, has its offices, the offices for Chagulani's party. The place has been cordoned off by security officials. They, the military, the police, they are all there. They have cordoned off most of the roads that are leading to the place. And there is a police patrol that has been stationed right at the gate of the offices. So no one has access to the offices. And even the salons, restaurants, shops around there have all closed because the operators have no access. Police has refused anyone to go near the offices. So that is the only place where maybe there is a heavy security presence and where people are not working right now.
You mentioned the NUP, its leader, Bobi Wine.
Yes.
His house
yes.
had been surrounded by the military and the police. Is that yes. still the case?
Yes. It is still surrounded. No one is accessing him. And actually, there is a group of lawyers that have written to the High Court in Kampala. They've petitioned, demanding that the High Court intervenes and calls for the release of Chagulani from his home, Chagulani and his wife. They want them released from their home because it's their constitutional right to be free to move anywhere. So the lawyers have filed their case. One of the lawyers says the couple has been denied access to their lawyers, so there is nothing they can do. Chagulani plans to petition against the polls of Thursday, but there is no way he can do that because he has no access to his lawyers.
Why is he still being detained in his home? Have the authorities said?
Because they have intelligence reports that Chagulani and other opposition politicians are planning to incite the youth in Kampala and other cities to riot against the polls, against the Thursday polls. Chagulani and the opposition politicians still oppose the outcome of the Thursday polls. So the police thinks that when Chagulani is released, he will join the other opposition politicians and they incite the youth. So that is the reason they are giving.
Now, also, the Ugandan government is accusing the U.S. ambassador of trying to subvert the election. Can you tell us about that?
I have not got information from Uganda government as yet to that effect, but yesterday the U.S. ambassador was blocked from accessing Chagulani according to the U.S. ambassador in a statement, all they were going to do at Chagulanyi's place was to check on his health and safety since he has been in the house for about 5 days now, since 14th. So they wanted to know, does he have supplies? Is he healthy? But the police blocked the Ambassador Brown from accessing the home. And in the statement, the ambassador doesn't give any reason why the government stopped her. And the government also has not come out to explain why they stopped her. But that was not the first incident. Earlier on, we saw the U.S. embassy was not able to observe the election because the Electoral Commission cut the number of people they accredited from the embassy.
That was reporter Catherine Nambi in Kampala speaking with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson. A Libyan political dialogue arranged by the United Nations has made progress towards agreement on a transitional government to oversee the run-up to elections in December. Acting UN Libya envoy Stephanie Williams said the agreement represented the best possible compromise on the issue and could lead to the selection of a transitional government in several weeks. Meanwhile, the UN Security Council has approved the appointment of Slovakia's former foreign minister as the UN Libya envoy. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi discussed these developments with Wolfgang Poshtai, former Austrian military attaché in Libya.
For the time being, the quite complex mechanism was just agreed in the 18-member LPDF advisory committee and not in the forum of the 75 members of the whole LPDF. These 18 delegates were selected by acting UN Special Representative Stephanie Williams. Currently, the voting in the 75-member LPDF is going on. There is not yet an outcome. In the first round, a 63% majority is required, and thereafter, a simple majority would be sufficient to adopt the mechanism. So it is likely that the mechanism will be adopted in the next days. And the mechanism foresees a need for a 70% majority in the first round to confirm the respective representatives from the three regions and the jointly selected prime minister, 70%. If this is not the case, there will be a system of lists at the very end. One of the lists will be selected by a relative majority. So this could very well happen. But this list with the Prime Minister and the members of the Presidential Council must be thereafter confirmed by the House of Representatives and the High Council of State. If this is not the case within 60 days, the confirmation will be carried out by the Libya Political Dialogue Forum itself. And this brings me to the question, does a confirmation by an unelected body like the LPDF give legitimacy in the eyes of the Libyans? I doubt it. So if the Presidential Council and the Prime Minister are only agreed by the Libya Political Dialogue Forum, it could very well be the case that Libya will get a third non-generally recognized government.
Two delegations representing the Libyan Parliament and the Libyan State Council are in Cairo to discuss the constitutional roadmap, which is perceived as more complicated than the political and military tracks. What are the best options for a Libyan constitution?
Actually, it is more complicated and eventually also of a longer reaching impact. Currently, the amended constitutional declaration from 2011 is still in force. This is a slim 11-pager, which was intended to cover only a very short period of time. A constitutional draft assembly was elected in March 2014, and they agreed on a draft after 3 years in 2017. The original plan was that this draft should be endorsed by the parliament and thereafter to be subject to a referendum. You know it, both never ever took place. It was not even clear, and it is still not even clear, what kind of majority would be required for the referendum. Is this about 50% or two-thirds of the voters all over Libya, or 50% in each of the three historic regions? The draft itself is a weak compromise, which leaves many key questions open. From my point of view, a better option would be to adopt the amended and slightly modified version of the Libyan Independence Constitution from 1951. This was a federalist constitution, and yes, it was about the monarchy, but the changes could include a replacement of the king by a three-member presidential council, and the constitution necessarily needs to include a formula for the distribution of the oil revenue between the three historic regions. Another option would be to use the 51 constitution as amended in 1963, which established a more centralized state. It is really decisive that Libya should get now an interim constitution. They should agree on a final constitution after the situation is more stable. Legitimacy to such an interim constitution could be provided by the House of Representatives, which could serve on as a House of Representatives under both versions of the old constitution, and the High Council of State, which would become the Senate under this interim constitution. So to adopt the Federalist Constitution on a temporary basis is, from my point of view, the only one promising way ahead.
The UN Security Council has approved the appointment of Slovakia as former foreign minister as the UN new Libya envoy. How could that advance the prospects of peaceful political solution to the Libyan conflict?
This is a very positive move. UN Secretary General Guterres has certainly realized that the UN-led stabilization process is now in a very, very difficult situation. A new special representative is able to start new initiatives based on what has been achieved so far. It is important that Jan Kubis enjoys freedom of action, unlike his predecessor, Ghassan Salameh, who needed to start with the determinations made at the Paris conference in May 2018 under the French President Macron, where the key Libyan leaders decided to hold or agreed to hold elections in December the same year with an entirely unrealistic timetable and without any preconditions met. Jan Kubis' first priority should probably be to foster the ceasefire and thereafter to get to an interim constitution. General elections should be held as soon as the country is ready for them. I doubt that this is the case already this year in December as planned by the non-legitimate Libya Political Dialogue Forum.
That was Wolfgang Paschtei, former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Scientists in South Africa say mutations to the original coronavirus are helping it better evade the body's immune system. They revealed a new mutation or variant of COVID-19 in December. New forms have also been found in Britain and Brazil, and scientists say other mutations are present around the world. Darren Taylor has more.
Over time, small changes occur naturally in a virus trying to survive by making copies of itself. Most of the mutations don't affect how the virus works, but some can be significant. The co-chair of South Africa's COVID-19 Advisory Committee, Professor Salim Abdul Karim, explains that the defining part of the coronavirus is the so-called spike protein. It allows the virus to attach itself to human cells. Karim says the variant found in South Africa, known as 501YV2, is a change that is indeed very significant.
The virus and the spike protein now rotates about 20 degrees so that it's able to approach more deeply into the binding site, so that its affinity and its ability to bind to the human cell is now stronger. And that's what enables it to become a more efficient virus in the way it transmits. And we're seeing that.
The internationally renowned epidemiologist says the new conclusions confirm that the new variant is driving a second wave of the pandemic in South Africa.
We are now seeing today more cases and more deaths than we ever on any day saw during the first wave.
But Karim emphasizes this does not mean that the variant is deadlier than the original coronavirus. It's simply more infectious.
What we have seen is that it spreads much faster. It's left to be seen whether it will end faster, but certainly it has spread much faster.
He says the 501YV2 mutation is 50% more transmissible than previous variants present in South Africa. Karim, however, says data shows people aren't dying because the variant is in itself more severe. There just aren't enough beds and ventilators that could save their lives. He adds that South African scientists are also trying to answer a very important question.
Is there any evidence on whether the COVID-19 vaccines are effective or not against this variant? I'm sorry to tell you, not yet. Many, many scientists across the world are working on this. I'm in direct communication with several of them. We don't yet have an answer. We're expecting an answer pretty soon, and there's much to speculate on.
But, says Karim, research from the University of Washington on the 484 mutation present in the variant is concerning.
They took different viruses, and they showed that the 484 mutation is important and particularly plays a big role in creating immune escape. In other words, in enabling the virus to escape existing immunity. Those viruses that have a 484 mutation can escape those antibodies and still survive despite those antibodies.
He says this does not mean that the world's vaccine approach should change, not at this stage.
Vaccines, like we see with the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines at 95% efficacy, are amongst the most effective vaccines that we have for any disease. And they achieve a critically important goal, which is they reduce clinical illness and hospitalization.
Other scientists have told VOA that should the current vaccines prove to be less effective in the new variants, they'll need minor changes. These will take a few months to develop. In the future, they say, people who received the original jabs may need another updated version for better protection against COVID-19. But for now, they'd like as many people as possible to get vaccinated as fast as possible with the shots currently available. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Kenyan scientists have raised an alarm on a coronavirus variant they say differs from the one spreading in South Africa and Britain. Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
About 10 investigators from the Kenya Medical Research Institute, or KEMRI, discovered the mutation of the virus responsible for the COVID-19 disease. Charles Agoti, a principal investigator and researcher, says that the variant unique to Kenya was detected in a batch of samples taken from Taita Taveta County, located in the southeastern part of the country.
Our interpretation is that because in this one place in Kenya, we were seeing it representing the majority of the sequenced samples, it does imply that actually it could if it has intrinsic properties to be more transmissible, it could result to increased number of cases locally.
Between June and October of last year, KEMRI sequenced around 205 genomes in the coastal region and further identified around 16 circulating mutations, all of which have so far proven harmless. Agoti says that the variant will not at this stage have an impact on the effectiveness of new coronavirus vaccines.
I think it's unlikely. This is just only one change in the about 1,200 amino acids long spike protein. So still there are very many other bits of the virus which the current vaccines target and can be able to neutralize the virus effectively.
According to the World Health Organization, these variants of concern, which are on the rise in 47 countries in Africa, may impact a person's immune response and need to be investigated further. Rudy Eggers is the WHO representative in Kenya. Eggers says that the mutations are a cause of concern worldwide.
So the vaccines, as far as we can say, will still be effective. So that's as far as we can notice at the moment. But this is very early days, and we'll have to do more research on that. From the early indications, it seems that the vaccines that are generally available against this virus are still holding and still are protective, but it's possible that actually there will be a decrease in the efficacy of the vaccine.
Brazil, the World Health Organization noted, is one of the countries where a new variant has also been found. Experts at Duke University's Global Health Innovation Center say they fear that the world may need to roll out second-generation vaccines even before first-generation vaccines have been fully introduced. Andrea Taylor is the assistant director at the North Carolina-based center.
So the current slate of COVID vaccines work by targeting the spike protein. However, the Brazil strain, for example, changes the shape of that protein, and our current vaccines may not be as effective against this or future mutations. unless we can control spread everywhere, we could find ourselves in the position of needing second-generation vaccines before we have even rolled out the first generation.
According to the latest data from the Johns Hopkins University, Africa has around 3 million reported coronavirus cases with a fatality count of 76,000. Johns Hopkins also says more than 99,000 Kenyans are infected and 1,700 people have died. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
The UN Refugee Agency reports thousands of Eritrean refugees trapped by fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province are in desperate need of food and other essential supplies and services. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Ethiopian government has denied humanitarian agencies access to Eritrean refugee camps since it began its military offensive in early November. After repeated requests, the UN Refugee Agency reports the authorities finally granted the agency a one-time access to two refugee camps, Mai Eni and Adi Harush in northern Tigray. UNHCR spokesman Baba Baluch says aid workers have found conditions in the camps dire and the Eritreans in desperate need of humanitarian aid.
Refugees were cut off from any supplies and services for more than 2 months. Wells were not functional without fuel for the pumps, leaving refugees to use water from a nearby creek for washing, cooking and drinking, resulting in diarrhea-like illnesses.
Baluch says a one-time food distribution by the World Food Program 1 month ago is the only assistance the refugees have received for more than 2 months. He says plans for a second distribution are underway. In the meantime, UN staff who access the camps have distributed food to 25,000 refugees. Baluch says the number of beneficiaries is of concern because there were 50,000 Eritreans in the two camps before the conflict erupted. So it is likely many fled in fear of their safety.
Refugees told our staff that while they were not impacted directly from the fighting, they were threatened and harassed by various armed groups. The refugees told us they continue to have safety concerns, reporting armed gangs roam the camps at night, stealing and looting.
Before the conflict began, Tigray sheltered 96,000 Eritrean refugees in four camps. Baluch says the authorities continued to deny aid agencies access to the Shemelba and Hitsuts refugee camps further north in Tigray. He says the UNHCR continues to receive reports of significant damage to those camps and of refugees fleeing in search of safety and food. Of even greater concern, he says, are worrying reports of refugees being abducted and forcibly returned to Eritrea, where their lives could be at risk. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For the fourth day, Tunisians, angry and disappointed about high unemployment rate and a financial crisis, have been protesting in various cities across the nation, including in the capital, Tunis. The Associated Press reported that Prime Minister Hichem Mihiti has reshuffled his cabinet over the weekend in an effort to inject new blood into the government. Still, the defiance continued with protesters blocking streets and setting barricades on fire. Police responded with tear gas, and the defense ministry says it has deployed the army in some regions to protect private and public property. The protests erupted last Friday, days after the country commemorated the 10th anniversary of the ouster of iron-fisted former president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. A budding democracy grew out of the aftermath of the Tunisian revolt. But despite some gains, disenchantment is high amid extremist attacks, political infighting, a troubled economy, youth unemployment reaching 30%, and the poverty level at 20%. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.